Welcome to Inside the Spec. We are the podcast that bridges the gap between building product manufacturers and the architects who specify them. Each episode brings you unfiltered insights into how architects find, evaluate, and specify building materials. I'm your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, and CEO of Point to Point. We're an advertising agency focused in securing the architect's spec through results-focused marketing. And I'm joined by my co-host, Vardhan Mehta, a second-gen architect and founder of AceLab. AceLab is an AI-driven product selection platform that brings architects and manufacturers together early in the design process.
Whether you're a manufacturer looking to better serve the architectural community or a supplier seeking to understand the evolving needs of design professionals, Inside the Spec delivers actionable intelligence straight from the source. Inside the Spec, because understanding how architects think is the first step to becoming the architect standard.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Inside the Spec. I am your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, CEO of Point to Point. And I am super excited today to be joined by Dave Lamont. Dave is the executive chairman of AceLab, and it's his first time co-hosting. So welcome, Dave.
Nice to be here, Megan. Hi.
Yeah. And then it's my great pleasure. I got two Daves today. So we're going to call Dave Lamont Dave, and we're going to call Dave Bernardino David, very formal. So David Bernardino is our special guest today. He is a fractional executive with extensive experience in building materials. He has a lot of really interesting things that he does within his practice, but today we're really going to focus on the finance aspect of it. So beyond the bank, alternative capital sources that can exist to help you scale your business more rapidly, things that not everyone knows about. So welcome, David.
Great to be here, Megan. Thanks for having me. And Dave, pleasure to meet you as well.
Yeah, nice to meet you, David.
So David, tell us more about Bernardino Enterprises. What does it mean to be a fractional executive? What are the types of services that you're helping offer your clients in our industry? And you extend into more, not just building materials products, but my understanding is that you also do things in development and you do things in build tech. You know, so explain to us the ecosystem that you are addressing.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Megan. My kids actually ask this of me a lot. And
ultimately,
at the end of the day, yeah, exactly, right? But ultimately, what I view my role to be is one of two things. One is solving problems, you know, through the lens of a marketer, because I've been in the marketing world for, gosh, you know, a really long time. I'm not going to date myself. But second, how do you connect? You know, connect various parties. And we'll talk about this further in the pod. So how do I work? So I work with a bunch of companies across a wide variety of challenges. In one instance, it's helping them scale up their marketing program, you know, as they're going through the life cycle of a startup, going from A round to B round to, you know, yada, yada, yada. In other instances, it's helping provide a strategic voice as they're trying to figure out how to navigate a potential real estate development project in the Caribbean. You know, which is sort of how we sort of dovetailed into this conversation, Megan, right? In other instances, it's helping an AI platform that's trying to transform e-commerce scale up their operations in the US. They're doing really well in Singapore and in Asia. They're trying to figure out how they can reapply that technology into the US on their boots on the ground. So at the end, it's about helping my friends figure out solutions to growing their businesses, growing their brands, and being super creative as far as how we go about doing it. You know, think of it as a singer-songwriter, right? You know, my job is to ultimately write the song and then bring in the various studio musicians to help produce the recording.
Mm-hmm. I like that analogy. That's actually one that I have not heard before. So good job there.
I have now my guitar handy.
So where does the capital component of what you do fit in with all of those different services?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, but ultimately, right, capital is think of it as fuel to grow a business. So it doesn't matter if you're an early, you know, startup, literally working out of your garage, or you're a Fortune 50 organization, right? Ultimately, you're trying to put together a thesis as far as where you want to take the business. You know, where to play, how to win, right to win, all those things. And we can talk about that later if you want. you define those choices, but then ultimately, how are you going to fuel that? Capital is the fuel to enabling you to deliver it at its very foundational level. And so how do I get involved? In some instances, it's to use another metaphor. Remember the movie Hitch, where Will Smith is the dating consultant trying to help the character do the thing. Well, what I've encountered is that a lot of founders need help with respect to doing their sales story, their pitch story. Because ultimately, you want to tell a story to a potential investor with the goal of changing their behavior. And what is the behavior change? It's them cutting a check. So that's one part of it. But then the question is then, how do you know which types of capital or which types of money or which types of potential investors you want to go after? Because it's not like there's a yellow pages for different types of capital, or it's not like, you know, you're a founder and you can call 1-800 Goldman Sachs and press 5 for family offices, press 6 for private equity, press 7 for private capital. That doesn't exist, right? And so how do you start to navigate that piece and, again, connect the two ecosystems? Because, you know, there are a lot of folks that are out there on the investor side that are looking for projects to fund. There are clearly a lot of founders that are looking to find capital. The question is, how do you bring the two ecosystems together and see if there's a there? That's ultimately how I help a lot of those organizations. Again, it's about changing that behavior, but with the goal of helping the founder raise capital.
You know, David, I'm very familiar with venture capital. You know, I've run startups for most of my career. How is the capital you're looking for different than VC, traditional VC capital that high-tech startups look for?
Yeah, you know, it's different in that their fundamental thesis as far as why they raise the money is going to be different. Their investment horizons might be different. You know, sometimes they might be able to take a longer term position on a thing because they're not, again, their thesis might be fundamentally different. They might be willing to take more of a risk or less of a risk. But ultimately, their view is that, you know, as opposed to a standard VC model where at a specific round, I'm going to raise X and I'm going to take Y percent of the company. They might say, you know what, I'm going to come in instead and be passive money and say, hey, I'm going to cut you a check and be less active in the business, but let you more as a limited partner per se and let you run the thing and grow it. Keep me abreast of what's going on and see what's out there. But again, it's somewhat of a hybrid of the traditional VC model, but it's different at the same time because ultimately their thesis as far as how and why they want to invest their dollars is different. And so because of that difference and because they're, you know, held to different standards within their organizations, they're going to approach projects a bit differently. That's ultimately what it boils down to.
Got it.
So, you know, I'm a founder. I had to go get money to purchase the business from the prior owner. My husband is a banker. He's a commercial banker at a large bank. So I'm more familiar with the more traditional sources of lending. Like I have an SBA loan, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the types of things that he does. But tell me about what the alternative options are beyond going to a bank that you're familiar with. You know, I even think some people and myself could use help understanding the difference between business banking, institutional investments. You know, I think the idea of private, you know, family office, you know, or other private investors is something that a lot of people are unfamiliar with. Can you kind of break down what the different avenues may look like?
Yeah.
So that people can understand that better. And then I really liked what you were talking about in terms of the storytelling, you know, and like we can go back and I think talk about what those different investor groups might be looking for in terms of a story, because their motivations and their levers and how they make money is different across all of them, right?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, and you started to lay out the landscape, Megan, right? Like there's commercial, right, which is a traditional bank, right? You know, Wells Fargo, Fifth Third, right? They have their ways of lending, but they tend to be very much, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to give you a loan. I'm pretty risk averse. Yeah, I want certainty to return. Got it, right? Check. And that's the stuff that everyone's familiar with. Then you start drilling down. You might have your institutional investors, you know, the Goldman Sachs, the Morgan Stanleys of the world, right? They tend to operate very differently. And maybe the check sizes that they're going to cut, there's a minimum that they're going to want to cut to make sure that the deal actually works out. Because ultimately, they're all about scale, right? So for them to touch a small deal, it's probably not worth their time. And if you look at it from their side, from their P&L, it's probably not even profitable, again, given the beast that they have to feed. But, you know, depending on where you're at in your life cycle, that's absolutely an option. Then you start to get into the private folks, whether it's private debt, private equity. And these folks tend to operate very differently. You know, and so, you know, there are private equity firms in the building materials space where their job is, you know, some of them is focusing on acquiring different types of building material manufacturers, scaling up and exiting. And so they're going to approach their investments in a very different way than, say, a commercial bank where they just want a rate of return and guaranteed cash flow back. You know, a PE firm might say, hey, I'm going to acquire your startup, Megan, because you know what? It fits a portfolio that I'm trying to build, which then in 3 to 5 years, I potentially want to sell out to, you know, whether another PE firm, a conglomerate, could be to a potential VC, but they're using private sources of capital to acquire businesses for a particular purpose. And you're just one cog in the machine. Credit at the same time is accepting the debt. Family offices, it's really, think of it as super wealthy families that have a bunch of money that need to deploy that capital in a certain way to achieve the returns for that particular family. You know, so, you know, say you're a gazillionaire, Dave, right? And you have $100 million in the bank and you want to invest in sustainable green technology, right? You might have, you might, as a family, bring in an investment manager, you know, probably someone, ex-Wall Street guy, to come in and invest those dollars. But your job ultimately is to provide returns for the family. And since it's the family and not shareholders or other investors, it's your own capital, you might view your appetite for risk. You might view your investment horizons. You might view the returns that you require on those investments very differently because, again, it's your own money. You know, as a family office, it's not like you're answerable to anyone else. You're just answerable to yourself. So then there are other types of capital that's out there. You know, you can get really obtuse. And there are a lot of folks that go, you know, you can tokenize those assets, right? And start getting into the crypto world. But at a high level, you know, you're having your commercial, your institutional, your private, your family offices. That covers the 80 for the 20 these days. And family offices are just growing like there's no tomorrow. You know, it's amazing the amount of family offices that are out there because, again, with the market being the way it is, there's a lot of capital to deploy. And some folks are saying, you know, I'm going to just take this in my own hands and figure a way to do it myself.
It sounds, though, like it's really about matchmaking here.
Yeah.
Because different investors have different agendas. And, mm-hmm. you know, if your story doesn't match their agenda, you're wasting time.
Correct. And that's the key thing. What we always say is not every check is created equal. And I'm sure you've been through that in your career, Dave, right? It's, you know,
checks I don't want.
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. And as founders, we all have been through that where, you know, you approach a check writer and you realize that we're not aligned. You sort of get that weird feeling. Yeah, because their thesis or what they want doesn't match what you're trying to achieve. And I think that's the rub, right? Trying to ensure that the founder and the money actually find the right match. Because ultimately, if you find the right match, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. If you don't find the right match, you end up getting to the classic horror stories that we all hear of or probably have experienced where, you know, the money's going after you and you're just like, what the hell? Like, I thought we were partners. Instead, these are sharks.
What about strategics? Do you find that other companies in the space that are leaders, like in building product manufacturing, yep. will invest in companies that want to come from other parts of the world and enter the U.S. market, for instance?
There's strategics, actually. That's a great build, Dave. They're a new growing class, right? You know, on the corporate venture side. And these are companies that have investment arms. And their job is to either find strategic partnerships with startups or with founders or to actually make acquisitions. You know, it's a practice that actually was started in the consumer healthcare space and in the CPG world. You know, when I was at Procter & Gamble, we had a group called Connect and Develop, where their job was literally to look at various companies to take stakes in and potentially to draw partnerships because it actually enabled them to reduce risk from an R&D perspective and actually potentially commercialize more quickly. You know, the pharmaceutical industry does this in droves. If you think about it, pharmaceuticals, they don't spend a lot of dollars on hardcore R&D at this point. You know, a lot of the breakthrough drugs are through acquisitions and partnerships. Right. You know, the classic one is, you know, the COVID vaccine. you know, don't care about your political proclivities, but Moderna and BioNTech is the company, and Pfizer, right? Pfizer did not actually develop the vaccine. It was BioNTech.
Right.
And used Pfizer's distribution arm to get that to market. You know, so it's just a reapplication of that model that's already been out for years. Again, just like all things building industry, we're a little bit behind and we're starting to catch up.
Well, my career has been based on the point that large companies are probably not going to innovate on their own.
Right. And that's the thing, right? You know, because again, you know, you and I have been in the, you know, in the large organizations, you tend to get siloed, right? And you tend to get ossified in your thinking. The only way you're going to become disruptive is you got to bring in thinking from the outside.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, they
so become how do you more do risk- that in a choiceful way?
You have more to lose. You're more risk averse, right? Right? And you have, you still, even with scale, you're dealing with, you know, finite resources and energy, and you're scaling the things that are working well in the market at scale already, right? Yep. Versus identifying niche new product applications that are able to fit new market needs.
Correct.
And there's a part of what Dave Lamont said that I want to make sure we come back to, because this is actually what Dave Bernardino, where you and I have had a lot of conversation. There's a lot of entities that have been successful overseas, like in Europe, or specifically, it seems like we're getting a lot of Australia interest in the building product space of innovative products that have been successful in other markets. Yep. That are setting up licensing agreements with founders for the US market, but they need capital to be able to scale here. It's not the entity as it exists back home, wherever home may be, isn't giving them the funding to set up manufacturing, and all, they're basically giving them the rights to be the distribution for that product in the US, but mm-hmm. they have to do it on their own, right? Yep. And so that's a lot of what you and I have been talking about in terms of how you bring those innovative net new products to scale, mm-hmm. to market, to scale, right?
Yep. Yeah. And that's a thing, you know, and, you know, the blessing and the curse of our industry is that we're probably the most dynamic housing market in the world, right? Just given the diversity and just sort of the way the market's set up, it's very fragmented, unlike a lot of other markets in the world. The curse is that, you know, we're also very insular as an industry and very resistant to change. Whereas there's a lot of great innovation and great ideas that exist outside our shores that we could potentially reapply and reapply at scale. The class, everyone's now talking about the Japanese and Sekisui and what they're doing, you know, just one, you know, very known case right now, as far as bringing innovative business practices to another market. But, you know, as you and I have talked, Megan, there are plenty of other instances where milk materials from other parts of the world are driving some really interesting innovation that need to find a home in the US. How do you start to raise money for those instances? Because they're adding value. They're doing something that is unique to the market, right? How do you ensure that those things get funded? And so, you know, part of it is defining the story, right? It's defining how you want to serve yourself up. And then the other part of the piece is, and Dave, you and I talked about this earlier in the pod, right? It's making sure you find the right money, right? Is it a strategic? Is it a family office? Is it private equity? So going through that exercise of, you know, how do we want to serve ourselves up? Who do we want to serve that thing to? That's the important piece. Because again, you know, for the use cases that you and I have been talking about, Megan, it's, you want to make sure that those founders that are trying to scale these great technologies from abroad in the US actually have the runway to succeed.
I think the whole issue about the right money is an interesting topic because, you know, what is the agenda of the people that you are investing with that are going to become partners of yours? Are they going to want to try to control your business? Right. Are they going to make the right introductions for you that allow you to grow that business? Are they going to introduce you to other capital? You know, and so I think a company knowing what they want and then evaluating that investor probably, you know, is an important lesson that I, you know, I've learned over time. You know, just to switch to another topic real quickly, I noticed your background in P&G, mm-hmm. and I'm sort of fascinated by, you know, as Megan mentioned, the P&G, the storytelling aspect mm-hmm. of getting this right, to get yep. to find the right partner. What are some of the lessons you've learned about telling the right story?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because the way I like to approach this is similar to how we would try and convince a massive retailer like Walmart to take in a new brand. It's actually the same thing, because ultimately you're trying to change behavior, right? You're trying to change, you know, the investor's behavior to invest in you, or in the case of a consumer packaged goods company, you're trying to convince a major retailer to take in your new item. And so you need to start framing the sell story in a way that makes sense. And it starts with understanding first, like, what are they thinking today at its most foundational level? Like, how are they viewing your potential service, the thing that you're trying to solve? Like, just understanding, like, what's in their head. You know, so to use the example of the retailer, I think that's an easier example to look at, right? You know, Walmart's probably, you know, and let's say coffee, right? You're trying to launch a new coffee brand. Walmart's probably thinking that, you know what, I'm doing just fine with my coffee assortment, right? I got, you know, Folgers, I got Pete's, I got some other brands, but I'm doing just fine. I'm probably growing like 3% a year or whatever. Why do I need a new brand? Ultimately, you as, you know, P&G back in the days, you know, when they used to have a coffee business, you know, let's say they wanted to launch a new brand and get into Walmart. Ultimately, the behavior they want to change in Walmart is for them to accept your new brand, right? That's ultimately why, and treat your new brand as the thing. What's getting in the way, right? That's the rub that we need to figure out. Like, what is getting in the way? Is there an unmet need? Is there a barrier to adoption or whatever that needs to come true? And you start to map that out, right? So in the case of capital, right? What's the unmet need? What's the barrier to adoption to things like you? And that's part of understanding their goals, their thesis, and understanding everything you can about that particular investment class or whatever it is. You start to map out that journey to figure out, okay, for us to change that behavior, how do we need to serve ourselves up in a way that appeals to them, in a way that says, oh, I can't live without you? Because ultimately, you know, in the case of, you know, a retailer, they probably have to kick out another brand in order for your brand to come in. So you need to demonstrate that you're going to deliver superior growth with you in it versus you without it. In the case of, you know, an investment, you might have to demonstrate that. In the case of the investor, you might have to prove that, you know, investing in you is going to deliver better returns than either holding the money or potentially investing in other vehicles. But again, understanding what is going to drive them to change their behavior is foundational. And then it's all about framing the narrative, right? And, you know, Megan, you and I have been in the advertising world, right? You know, framing the narrative is critical, but understanding that, in a sense, consumer behavior journey, but reapplied to a different context is going to be mission critical, because then you can start to frame your story by saying, all right, here's the pain point. Here's what we're doing. Here's how we're going to come to life. Here's sort of the size of prize. Here's our moat, right? All those things that you want in a pitch deck come naturally, but it's rooted in an understanding of, hey, this is what we need to do to change that check writer's behavior in a way that is advantageous to us as the founder.
Yeah. Well, where you started with, it's, you know, and it's using Walmart as the example, Walmart's your customer. And mm-hmm. What you're doing is really putting, what is my customer looking for? What problems am I solving for them at the core of it, and building your story around it. But right. In your example, you assume that you already know that Walmart is where you want to grow.
Correct.
Right. And I think what you have seen is that a lot of the founders that you're talking to, they don't know if they want to do institutional. They don't know if they want to do strategic. They don't mm-hmm. even know that family office exists.
Correct.
Right.
Yep.
And so how do they begin to become aware? Like, how does the story change across those? Or how much of your own story do you need to figure out? And then you figure out what those options are, and then you adjust your story based on the customer. Mm-hmm. You know, like, how does that work?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of trial and error. This is where the art, you know, and science comes into play, right? We always talk about marketing being a blend of art and science. And, you know, first and foremost, it's let's get your foundational story together. Because 80 for 20, the story is going to be the story, right? It is what it is. Then, and this is where you work with various folks, you know, on your team, or if you're going to partner with someone that's done raises before or whatnot, they can help guide you based off of their knowledge of the money and their relationships with the money. Because again, a lot of this is all relationship driven. That's the other piece. So if you partner with the right people that have relationships with these check writers, they're going to be able to guide you saying, hey, you know what, this corporate venture fund is really interested in being framed in a certain way versus that family office is interested in learning things in a different way. But again, you know, the foundation of your story is going to be the same. The tweaks are going to be on how you serve it up, how you voice over certain things, what certain points you're going to highlight versus not highlight. Again, all that comes through the, you know, and especially if you are a founder and you end up partnering with someone to help you with the pitch, their ability to understand the relationships, you know, that they have and helping you tweak your story accordingly. Again, going back to the CPG example, how I'm going to frame my sales story to Walmart is going to be different to how I'm going to frame my story to Albertsons in the grocery channel versus how I'm going to frame my story to Costco and Club versus how I'm going to frame my story to Dollar General. 80 for 20, the story is the same, but Dollar General is going to be looking at, you know, a totally different set of metrics than say Walmart, which is going to look at units per store per week, you know, over a certain threshold versus maybe the grocery chain where velocity isn't going to be as important, but they're really concerned about retail margin. So again, yeah, understanding those nuances, but your foundational story is going to be the same.
And in our world, you could put Home Depot, Lowe's, right. Menards, you know, correct. And any of those, Ace Hardware, you know, any of those into those different buckets, right? Correct. You know, similar mentality.
Same principles. It's just reapplication of the same principles.
Well, David, what I was thinking about, you know, a lot of our customers are building product manufacturers, obviously. And so what are investors looking for? Are they looking for product innovation? Are they looking for the level of investment they made in sustainability in those products? Are they looking for their go-to-market programs? What resonates the most, do you find?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Ultimately, they want to see the whole package, you know, at the end of the day, because ultimately they want to understand, do you have your ducks in a row, right? You know, and so I go back to, you know, where to play, how to win, right to win, right? Being able to frame that out and do you have a deep understanding of and a clear point of view on the answers to those three questions, right? Where to play, right? You know, understand, you know, your target audience, what's your right to, what are you trying to solve for? You know, what's the value proposition that you're going to bring to the table? You know, and, you know, where are you going to actually activate that? You know, are you going to activate that in a specifier channel? Are you going to activate that through distribution? Are you going to activate that, you know, direct to the builder, whatever it is, right? Understanding, you know, your stuff from a business perspective and what you're trying to solve, you know, and then how to win, right? So how are you going to activate that, right? Have you done your homework and understanding how you're going to go to market, how you're going to drive specifications? And honestly, have you delivered a proof of concept that actually proves that that thesis is actually working, yes or no, right? Because the more that you actually are doing the thing, the higher degree of confidence is inspired, which means to an investor, the risk level is reduced. Right? It's all about risk versus reward. Then the right to win then says, okay, you versus you building material manufacturer versus other options on the market. Do you have a moat that's defendable that no one else can enter? If the answer is no, and you're more of a commodity product, right? Again, risk goes higher. If you're someone that's unique, special, and different in the marketplace, the risk becomes lower. Because ultimately, if you're a higher risk type of investment, the investor is going to want a higher rate of return. Right. It's just capital, you know, corporate finance 101, you know, versus if you're more of a sure thing, they're going to potentially be more flexible on the terms. So the more that you can do your homework up front, understanding where you stack up on those three fundamental questions, where to play, how to win, right to win, and being able to frame that out in terms of the investor's mindset of risk versus reward, the better suited you'll be able to marry the two together.
Is there a move to look for an AI story?
AI, I think there is, but what I found is that AI needs to be used in the right way. You know, AI for AI's sake is noise. And so really, it's about how is AI being used to help you deliver the thing that you're trying to offer? And how are you doing it in a way that drives adoption? Because ultimately, right, it's about our, you know, specifier specifying the product. Right. Our builder is actually using the material. You know, AI is going to be an enabler. It's called for what it is. It's a great productivity tool, but it's not going to be the be all end all, right? And so how you, the human, are framing up AI to deliver the thing, that's going to be the mission critical piece of the puzzle. If you just come in and say, AI is going to replace everyone, everyone's going to be like, dude, you're George Jetson. Like, this is totally not real. It's farcical, right? But if you say, hey, you know, given our foundational business model, it can work with and without AI. And here's how AI is going to accelerate or drive more productivity for from a specification perspective or from a builder's perspective in the way that's going to enable them to either A, earn more money or save more money, because ultimately that's what the industry, you know, our end users in the industry want. Help me earn more money or help me save more money. Then you got a compelling story to tell.
Well, we're going to do a whole one of our upcoming episodes is going to be all about AI use cases that exist within building products and architectural firms, too. You know, so that's going to be a big part of the future state of the season also.
I just have one follow up question, which is with the current political climate, do you see investment around sustainability being less right now, or is that an issue for building product manufacturers that have invested heavily in, you know, explaining how sustainable their products are?
You know, it's a mixed bag, right? You know, because ultimately there a lot of money was in the prior administration was being driven through the infrastructure bill, right? And all that stuff. But has sustainability been killed? The answer is no. You know, because ultimately, there are certain jurisdictions. You know, I'm sitting in one state, New Jersey, where, you know, green building is very much still a thing. And the building code is built to that certain standard. So in certain use cases, you know, the market's still demanding it, or the regulatory environment's still demanding it. So you still need to deliver the thing. The other piece of the puzzle that I would also argue in terms of sustainability is that there's sort of this third wheel of the building industry that no one talks about, which is insurance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ultimately, you know, the old adage, follow the money. Well, in a lot of jurisdictions, you know, the insurance industry is demanding that, hey, you know, we need to build better. We need to build more resiliently. We need all these things because, God forbid, if a Cat 5 hurricane comes through your neighborhood, I want the house to still be there.
Right.
And I'm not going to insure your home unless you do it. Right. And so I think there's also market forces that are going to drive innovation in sustainability. That's still going to be there irrespective of which administration is going to be in power. So again, if you're in the sustainable space, you got to find your swim lane in a sense and understand what's the use case that you're really delivering value. And then ladder on, okay, if the political environment goes one way, how is this going to impact the thing? Versus if the political environment goes the other way, how is that going to impact the thing? But ultimately, your core value proposition shouldn't change.
Right.
So one of the things that you mentioned, in addition to what we've been talking about, is the need for proof of concept, right? And a lot of building product manufacturers struggle with this from the architectural perspective. You can struggle with it from an insurance perspective, right? Mm-hmm. I have a great new product. It has labor savings. It has additional performance characteristics that mm-hmm. are dealing with different climate issues that people are struggling with. It's been done overseas, Singapore, Australia. Mm-hmm. Europe, right? Yep. You know, where a lot of this innovation can happen, trying to bring that to the US, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, trying to get those first installs from architects and owners, developers that can be risk averse. Like, it hasn't been done here before, right? Mm-hmm. How, and I know the bar can be high. I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. Like, well, I don't want to be the first project stateside that's using this. And you hear that a lot, right? Yeah. Do investors, institutional or otherwise, view the bringing of a product that's had exposure and decades of experience in an overseas market with the same level of risk that a developer and an architect may be looking at it with? Or are they more willing to take a global view? You know, do they share that? And I'm asking it as a yes or no question. But
yeah, no, I think the answer is it depends. No.
Yeah.
The answer fundamentally, it depends, which goes back to what is their investment thesis? Ultimately, how are they viewing the money and how do they want to deploy the money? Yeah, because you'll have some investors that are like, you know what? I'm US based. My point of view is US only. Ergo, if it's not done in the US, I'm not going to cut you a check. You might have other investors that are, you know, ex-US, you know, that are funding initiatives from outside the US that are like, oh, this is just white space market opportunity to expand the thing. They're willing to take a bigger risk profile because their view of the world and their reason for investing capital is fundamentally different. Again, it's this sort of the dollar amount is the same, but the reasons for cutting the check might be fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm. What do you see about foreign capital as a choice for things that are obviously coming from outside of the U.S. and haven't been tried here? Is that a good
source? It's a source that people should be tapping. One of the companies that I'm working with, a lot of their, they're ex-US. They're not in the building industry, but they're starting to enter the space, on the sort of the agentic AI world. But a lot of their money is potentially going to be coming in from sovereign wealth funds outside the US because they're founded outside the US. So their view of the world is that, hey, the US is the white space market. We're willing to take a more risk-seeking profile because this is white space expansion of the technology. So I think a lot of it depends on, for you as a founder, is what are you trying to solve for ultimately? What is the objective that you're trying to achieve? And then reverse engineer, right? Here are the potential ways to fund that. Foreign capital is absolutely a source that you need to tap. Again, it has its pluses and minuses, but just like any other choice that you can make, it should be evaluated.
What advice would you offer a building product manufacturer that wants to scale, has something innovative?
Yeah, it's the $64 million question. And ultimately, I'm a firm believer of first starting to understand what are your business objectives as a manufacturer? Like, where do you see the business in, 5 years or 10 years or whatever horizon you want to look at? So look at your long-term strategic plan, first and foremost, which is usually your 3 to 5 year planning document. And look at all the different choices that you've laid out. There are probably going to be 3 to 5 choices in that strat plan that say, all right, what are the 3 core levers that you're going to do to grow this business? It could be acquisition, it could be growth through white space expansion, it could be growth through getting new users or new architects into the space. Whatever those choices are, you got to frame that out. Then understand, okay, how's this disruptive innovation going to fit into that overarching long-term strategic plan? Because if it doesn't fit, then the question is, why is it there in the first place? So your innovation's got to be able to fit within the construct of your long-term strategic plan. So great, it has a role to play. Then the question is, how are you going to activate that, right? So if the overarching goal of the enterprise is, I just want market leadership, you might be viewing the financing of that particular choice in a different way versus if the goal of the enterprise is to sell and get acquired in 3 to 5 years. That will dictate different choices. But ultimately, I would say go back to your strategic plan if you're a building materials manufacturer and ask yourself the question, where do you want to go in the next 3 to 5 years? And then reverse engineer those strategic choices and see, all right, based off of that long-term objective, how does capital fit into that? How does product innovation fit into that? How does marketing fit into that? How do your operations fit into that? But ultimately, it's got to fit in within the construct of where do you want to take your business.
I think that's a powerful lesson. I've always thought that if we're going to enter into a partnership, you need to know what you want to get out of it.
Right.
And otherwise, it may just lead you down the wrong path.
Yeah. And go ahead, Megan. Well,
hang on a second, David. All right. So Dave Lamont, that's a great point, about entering into a partnership. And David Bernardino, I think this is a great opportunity to come back to Bernardino Enterprises, right? Mm-hmm. Because and explain now with everything that we've talked about, mm-hmm. more specifically, where can you begin to help people at Bernardino Enterprises? Do you help them create the story? Do they need to have the story already and you're giving them feedback on it? And then you create, are able to help them identify a great way to close this would be to explain, go back to where we started, and explain what you do and how you help.
Yeah, that's a great question. Ultimately, first and foremost, nothing needs to be baked. It can be as baked as you want or as unbaked as you want. I think ultimately the first question is, let's put together the story and let's understand what you're trying to achieve. Because different founders have different goals and objectives. I literally, before this podcast, was on a call with a founder. And literally, it was a discovery call. And we were asked, and I was asked them bluntly, like, where do you want to take this thing? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, we need to answer that question first. And we started to meander, but ultimately, his goal was he just wanted to license the technology. He didn't want to get acquired or whatever. He just wanted to license the technology and collect the royalty. I'm like, great. Let's figure out how to put together a licensing program over the next 90 days that helps you do the thing. So first and foremost, it would be, we'd help you understand, what do you want to achieve? What is your go-get? And then based off of that, we start to develop the story. So say it's the case of raising capital. Like if the goal is I want to raise money, then we start to put together, you know, the core elements of that story, putting together the data, right? Because ultimately investors are going to want to see the data in the data room. So making sure all that information's there, because ultimately that's sort of the price of entry. As we start to put together the pitch materials and all that stuff, part two of the conversation is, so given your objectives, you know, how do we start to match the money? And this is where, you know, the beauty of networks comes and ecosystems come into play. Because if they want a pure, you know, build tech, prop tech investor pool, you know what? I have a lot of friends that have done that thing. And so we'll tap that piece of it. If they want New York money and more just traditional private equity, private capital, high net worth individuals that are centered around the New York Wall Street ecosystem, got it. There are folks that I know that have those relationships for 30 or 40, 50 years, right? If we're looking at, you know, different types of alternative investment profiles, right, you start to tap the network. Because ultimately what you find is that in the capital world, it is very much a relationship-driven business. You know, when you're sitting in these investor dinners in New York City, you know, the power dinner and the power lunch is still alive and well, right? And being able to be in, quote unquote, the room with the check writers to have a conversation about what you're trying to do, it's still super effective. So it's understanding what you're trying to achieve, matching, all right, here are the potential areas where we can potentially raise money, and then connecting the ecosystems together. Because ultimately, when it comes down to the rub of founder to the investor, that's where I step away. Because honestly, I'm not FINRA registered. The SEC is super clear about that. But as far as connecting and making the introductions, yeah, go right ahead. You know, we're just, you know, friend, you know, in the sense it's a business development type of arrangement. But ultimately, what ends up happening between the investor and the founder, it's up to the founder, right? At the end of the day, sort of like a matchmaking service in the dating world, right? You know, Hitch can bring the, you know, the two parties together, but ultimately what happens on that date where, you know, you step away.
I'm thinking about the wardrobe consulting services that go with that too. But anyways, I'm right. Laughing.
But it's a similar analogy, right, Megan? And it, you know, ultimately it's, we can help the founder to a certain degree, but ultimately the founder has to make the story, has to give the pitch.
There has to be a match.
Has to negotiate the terms.
It's you know, your business is one of the most personal things that you can do. You know, owning a business is one of the most personal things that you can do. And who you partner with, you know, I have two partners and, you know, we have bank, we have a lot, you know, all of those relationships. You got to find people, like I like what you said at the beginning, I work with friends. You got to find people that care about you and have your best interests at heart and are willing to give you the advice you need to hear, which isn't always what you want to hear. And so I like that mentality, because that's how you build a trust-based relationship. And that's how you have friends for a long time, right?
Correct.
So, well, thanks team Dave. You know, that was great. I appreciate you both being here today. Yeah. That is the end of this edition of Inside the Spec. And we hope you join us for an upcoming episode.
Thank you.
Thank you.